Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I like relaxing. The best thing about relaxing is how relaxing it is. You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Reddy, but my friends call me Spanner, so let's be friends. We've got a mailbag episode lined up for you today. We've got some of your questions, and predictably, they do cover some of the biggest news that's been flooding the F1 news sites and social media. So we will be talking super licenses, a little bit about the Silverstone general admission and ticket prices, just so I can have a little grumble at the end. But loads of great topics to cover as well. And I have a great panel for you too. But first, I have to remind you that we're an independent podcast produced in the podcasting shed with the kind permission of our better halves. We aim to bring you a race review before your Monday morning commute. We might be wrong, but we definitely are first. Stop emailing us. We are first. We are. Well, we used to be, and that's enough. We are joined in the shed by Matt Two Rumpets. Hey, Matt.
Super license points? I don't need no stinking super license points.
How many super license points have you got? My dad's got like 55. He's got way more super license points than your dad.
Hey, I've been cutting those things out of newspapers since the 1950s, I want you to know.
I found some in some cereal. We've also got young commentating talent, Chris Stevens. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Spanners. My voice has just about recovered from what was a scintillating night of action in the Missed Apex iRacing F3 Cup. Go to Missed Apex Motorsport YouTube channel to check that out.
Yeah, and you had to solo, you had to Iron Man a single commentator because Chris Catman Turner couldn't be bothered to come and help you. But it was really good. You did a great job. You brought those races to life, and I do recommend people put them on, if only as background viewing, just to hear and bathe in your commentary.
Oh, thanks, man.
And from young talent to the opposite of that, we've got our video guy, Steve Amy, Uncle Steve. Hey, Steve.
How you going? The winter is disappearing down here. Summer's coming on and we're getting ready to burn.
All right. Winter in Australia is like nearly the hottest day in the UK anyway. I've heard you complain. You've gone, oh, we're down to 31 degrees. I've had to wear socks today.
Yeah, it's been very cold winter this year, though. The coldest winter since I moved up here, that's for sure.
Yeah. All right, then. Well, let's get on to the listener questions. Okay, Matt, you've been rummaging around in our mailbag. Why don't I make you IC in command of mailbag questions? I assume we have a lot of Colton Herter. What's his name? What was his name?
I forgot. Colton Herter.
Colton Herter.
Still his name, as a matter of fact.
No, I know, but like Colton to me doesn't sound like a real name. It sounds like a TV name. So when it came into my head, I was like, no one's called Colton.
Yeah.
We've got an iRacer called Colton.
Yeah, I know, but that there was a bit of like, it's just the disbelief. It's like
meeting an Australian called Bruce. Like, if you meet an American that's called Chad or Colton, you're like, no, that's only off of the telly. But Colton Herter, Matt, why don't we run through some of the questions we've had on Mr. Herter?
Okay, well, one of the nice things about doing the mailbag is that you get a very lot of questions on a certain subject, and you know you can do a deep dive. Everybody's going to be interested in it. That's what we're all going to talk about. And we actually have four separate entries in our Super License question program here. So we're going to start with Ernst, who would simply like to know if a super license can be taken away. Stephanie wants to know, is there a website that tracks points? Martin Dooley would like our opinion as to whether or not other roofed series would work well as proving grounds for Formula One. Ian thinks that super license is nothing about cashing in on American dollars rather than about how good Herta actually is. And I kind of agree with him on that. And then last of all, our friend Adam Deal would just like a simple explainer on what are the real rules for getting a super license. So perhaps we should start with that one.
No, just answer all of the questions in quick succession in one go. No, it's a really, really interesting field. And for me, it has been fascinating because this is genuinely a topic where I don't think anyone in our group was an expert. So we're all genuinely just trying to learn about this stuff. And loads of times when we're arguing about amongst ourselves and on Twitter and in the Slack group, we'd like make a, yeah, well, what about this point? And then we'd go and like research it and go, no, I was completely wrong about that point. I had no idea. So who's best placed now to give us a bit of a primer on what super license points are? Let's go with Chris.
Okay, so the FIA super license is basically a quality assurance. You have to go through certain series which offer a certain number of points towards your license. And you have to get, 40 to be able to get a super license. And then you can have a Formula One seat.
Or 30 with force majeure. Like, I guess, if you missed a season because a sparrow landed on your face and then you tripped and fell, then they go, okay, we'll let you off. You were pretty close. And they can do that from 30 points onwards.
There is like a contingency in it where I think you were allowed to have one under special circumstances. Like, I think Alex Albon technically didn't qualify for a super license before he joined Formula One.
Oh.
And it was only after testing that he was actually granted it.
Yeah. So, okay. So basically you have to get 40 points within 3 of the previous 4 years. So you've got a dropped year, but you've got 3 years to accumulate those super license points. How do I get super license points?
By winning championships, or at least finishing in the top three. That's where the big paying positions come in. If you're kind of outside of that, you're not really accruing the necessary points in anything other than Formula 2, I would say. So it's all about high scoring. And the ultimate aim is really to stop people buying their way into Formula 1. So you have to have credible championship results to be able to do it. And it's to stop people like Max Verstappen doing just 1 year of car racing and then coming into Formula One. So you have to accrue a certain number of points.
In fact, that was the very point I was going to make. The latest change to the super license point was brought about by Max Verstappen coming and racing in Formula One. And everyone's saying, he's not old enough. We need to change the rules. I will say that there is a secondary point to the FIA super license, and that is to keep all the money and sponsors walking up the FIA ladder and not going to other series.
Yeah, so this is my biggest gripe with the super license. I'm not going to hold any punches back here because...
Go for it.
The junior single-seater ladder, particularly Formula 3 and Formula 2, already got made super expensive when it was made a spec championship. It's the biggest lie in motorsport that spec racing is the cheapest, because instead of going out and teams garnering their own deals with engine suppliers or tyre suppliers or chassis suppliers and whatnot, they get given a fixed price, which is ludicrously expensive, and they say, that's it, you don't like it, you don't compete. So you have that problem already. Then the FIA forces you to go into these championships to have any hope of being a Formula One driver, which are ludicrously expensive. A season in Formula 2 costs anywhere between 1.5 to 2 million for the season, euros, depending on which team you're with. If you want any hope of winning the championship, it's at least 1.5.
Yeah, okay. But we should say, Matt, you know, if when this controversy came up and Herta got refused the super license, the way people were reacting, I honestly thought that basically, oh, IndyCar wasn't counted towards having a super license, the way people were so upset. But IndyCar gives substantial points for the FIA super license. And Chris is going to argue with me here. But had Colin Herta finished 6th, 8th, 20th, and 2nd in 4 championships, that would have been enough to qualify. He would have dropped his 18th or whatever. He would have accumulated 10 points from his 6th and 8th, and he would have got 30 points from finishing 2nd. You know, along those lines. Or he could have won the championship, or he could have finished 3rd, 3rd, 4th. So a top-level IndyCar driver does qualify for an F1 super license.
If they accumulate enough points. The thing with Herta is he has 32 points. Now, there may not be a force majeure. FIA may not want to consider it. But I think where a lot of this comes from is if you take a look at the actual table where they list the points, after third place, Formula 3 counts for more than IndyCar does. Formula 3 is a junior series. IndyCar is its own full-fledged championship with much higher level of competition in the top 10. And I think people are kind of rightfully, it's like it's making them a bit irate because, okay. Well, as Zach Brown, as Rossi said, there's no reason, there's no way you can say Herta isn't good enough to drive a Formula One car. So something's wacky about the system.
I'm not make no judgment on the over whether Herta is good enough to drive a Formula One car. I'll say the first thing that might generate emails, and it is a genuine question though, is what Formula One is an international sport. Indy, yes, it is its own thing, and it's not a junior driver series, but it's a regional series. And it is kind of given the same respect as other regional series, even more if you look at things like Super Formula or some Asian championships, Steve. So like, this is going to upset people, but isn't there some argument to go, well, it's probably a step up from IndyCar to F1?
Oh, it's definitely a step up. I doubt whether, you know, trying to equate Indy to Formula 3 is fair. I think that more skill involved, you know, in driving in Indy at a reasonable level in IndyCar than is, you know, given at the moment. Those drivers, you know, there are some drivers who have got lots of experience, have won lots of races. They might not have won the championship, but they've won a lot of races and they've had many years of experience. And I think that they could step across to Formula 1. I honestly think that there has to be, you know, kind of a realignment of the high levels of open wheeler, you know, that is raced around the world. Indy racing is probably not, you know, quite on the same par as Formula One, but it's closer than where it's been pegged at the moment.
Well, I think we need to be careful when we're talking about like levels where we say, you know, it is competitive. It's a spec series after all. So the competition is high. It's also very popular. But I think, you know, Chris, is it a factor that, say, the speed of an Indy car and what lap times it can do around a circuit equates more to F2 than F1?
Yeah, but I don't think that's a factor because for me, IndyCar is a higher level than Formula 2 in that it's where professional drivers go to actually make a career out of racing where they are getting paid to race rather than paying to race.
Big
and that
for
it makes it a much more competitive
thing.
But what I don't like is that it's closed off. You have other series that are closed off in this system. And drivers that would be more than competent enough for Formula One in, say, the top level of the World Endurance Championship or in Formula E or other, you know, other series that get snubbed because they're not coming through this particular route.
Steve?
I agree with Chris that we've got to open it up. You know, drivers that are in, you know, the endurance series and are good drivers should have an opportunity to step across. And at the moment, it is totally closed. I think if Nick De Vries gets a drive in Formula One next year, that's a good way to, you know, elevate Formula E and stop it from being the graveyard for ex Formula One drivers. You know, suddenly he will have come from being Formula E champion and step into Formula One, and that will open up another avenue of drivers being able to channel into the Formula One group.
Matt, Formula E doesn't carry as much weight as the IndyCar series. It's FIA. It fills the criteria that we were talking about before. It's its own thing. It's not a feeder series. It fulfills Chris's thing where you're getting paid to drive. You're not paying to drive. So, I mean, that's quite a good comparison to set.
Yes, I agree. I think Formula E should get more points. Having watched it firsthand, I can tell you it is a very highly competitive series. And because the car's performance tends to be so close together, unless you're Dragon Penske, then you have the same thing that you get in IndyCar, where a lot more of your result comes down to driver talent. And the point that I really wanted to make was you called Indy a regional series. If we're just looking at where they race...
I was trying to provoke
you. I would highly agree with you. Okay. However, if I look at where the racers are coming from, it seems a bit more international these days.
Well, it took a long time for you to wind up and get angry about that. Yes, I understand that it's international, but when I say it's regional, I think it's fair. Like, a lot of the drivers who are international came there, you know, from... If you look at Grosjean and Ericsson, they shot their shot at F1, and then, and I don't want this to sound rude, but they failed into IndyCar and are doing sort of fine. It's not like they went through the system. The international element of, say, the feeder series into IndyCar, I'm imagining, is a lot more North American.
You would think so, unless your name is Linus Lundqvist or Rhinus VK.
Yeah. Okay, so two.
What about Scott McLaughlin? He came from being 3-time supercar champion and is now doing great in IndyCar. Can't tell me he's not a talented driver.
No, not at all. But my point there is, Steve, you're right. That is an Australian-grown talent that's then migrated over to IndyCar. Whereas, you know, the F1 has an international ladder that goes into F1. IndyCar tends to, when you talk about its international element, is attracting drivers who've already shot their shot or developed in a different ladder. Chris?
Well, like, we can call IndyCar a regional championship, but Formula 2 is basically a regional championship as well.
For Europe.
It primarily races in Europe and has a couple of races in the Middle East to keep things, and, well, primarily to keep the promoters of those particular events happy. And what's kind of grating about this at the moment as well is that we're all looking at the Formula 2 field and seeing nothing spectacular. Like, nobody's really on the cherry hook for 2023.
Cherry hook? What's a cherry hook?
I don't know. I might have just made that up, but...
Well, okay, good. No, do you know what? From now on, that is a missed apex phrase. We use that all the time. So, Chris, like, you know, there are years where more drivers are on the cherry hook, but that you do get these non-cherry hook seasons, you know, where...
Now that you've said it, it sounds so ridiculous.
No, doubling down, sticking with it. That's the title of the show, in fact.
All right, great. No, but yeah, this particular season, I think the only driver who has an outside shot at a Formula One seat is Jack Doohan. And I think that is very unlikely and a very left field choice for Alpine. So I think there are more potential F1 drivers in IndyCar at the moment than in Formula 2.
Cherry hook.
So I think our dear friend Chris has forgotten about Logan Sargeant for the moment, but that's okay.
He's not going to be in Formula One next year. Come on. He just isn't.
Happens in the heat of the moment. What, he's not going to be driving for Williams, with whom he's contracted, if he has enough super license points? You think they'll keep Latifi instead?
No, I think they'll go with another option. Like, I think they're still desperately going to fight to have Nick De Vries.
Oh, you think so? Well, we shall see where Nick lands, given his given his dalliance with the Red Bulls, I suppose. But the other thing I wanted to say is that I remember watching when Grosjean just started driving an IndyCar. He actually got beaten by this kid, Rhinus VK. I want to say Dutch, but if I'm wrong about that, please forgive me, because it was over a year ago and I can barely remember what happened yesterday. But he in interviews basically said he chose to go to the United States and climb the IndyCar ladder, about which we can talk more later.
This is a good point, yep.
Because it was too expensive for him to compete in Europe, but he could afford to compete in the United States.
Yeah. And yeah. So this is the question I asked on Twitter, which is, as an American, Matt, and, you know, and I'm asking IndyCar fans who are kind of outraged. It feels like a slight, you know, like IndyCar has been disrespected because a well-rated, well-regarded driver from IndyCar is not, has basically not been deemed good enough or worthy for F1. So that is an insult. And I see that insult. But do you really actually want, say, the F1 to go, right, any IndyCar driver who's done a season in IndyCar can drive an F1. It's completely fine. If a team wants them, you can have them because we respect IndyCar so much. Do you want that? Because you will essentially become a feeder series. Young European billionaires from the UK will start flooding the Indy Lights or whatever, the feeder series, the USF 2000 will just be filled with like Francois Billon and all his mates. And that is going to have an effect on American talent. Do you really, really want this? Or are you not just happy for the best and brightest of each series to be able to cross over occasionally? It's a long question.
I'm not suggesting any driver who's ever driven an IndyCar race is qualified or should be able to swap over. But I think it's clear when you've got someone with the accomplishment of Herta, the fact that he can't is maybe an issue that needs addressing. But I do want to respond to your point, if I may, before we go on. Which is namely into it, the very nice thing about the IndyCar ladder is that if you have $5,000 and a stupendous amount of talent, you can start at the bottom and work your way all the way up to an IndyCar drive. You're guaranteed three races, one of them being the Indy 500, just by winning. You don't need to have the money or the sponsors, although they do hook you up as best they can along the way.
Currently, firstly, I'd like to express my disappointment that I neither have $5,000 or talent. So I'm not going to make a late charge to do that. But that's the system as it currently is. And that makes sense commercially. What once you start getting these supermarket billionaires bringing their kids over to start getting the seats and they start going, well, actually, I mean, we have got basically a limitless budget. We can offer you half of what it will cost us to be on the F3, F2 ladder. Money talks, you know, and you could find that Indy has, you know, the financial pressure to start accepting these drivers is overwhelming. So, go on, Chris.
So on Herta's kind of ability in his...
And CV, I'd like to know Herta's CV, actually, yes.
I mean, he is a multiple IndyCar race winner, and that in itself is a great achievement because it is an incredibly competitive series. But what really was surprising to me, I read it today, and please correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I do believe Linus Lundqvist, the Indy Lights champion, has more super license points than he does and actually qualifies for one, rather than Herta, who is an accomplished IndyCar driver, which to me makes no sense whatsoever.
Yep, you're absolutely correct. He does. And it doesn't make sense, which is why we're sitting here still talking about it, because it doesn't quite make sense.
Well, the reason I've given over so much of this program towards it is simply because, like, I didn't know anything about it to start with. And I think a lot of listeners will be sitting here going, oh, I didn't know any of that either, Chris.
Well, the super license in itself goes against what it's all doing, because we're talking about how it's so expensive to do F2 and F3. So you have to be a very wealthy driver to get through to the top of that anyway, which is what they didn't want happen. They wanted to stop pay drivers getting in. Now it's pretty much exclusively pay drivers or incredibly well-backed drivers. Yeah. When we still have people like Nicholas Latifi and Nikita Mazepin slipping through the cracks, and it wanted to stop young drivers from getting in because Max Verstappen was 16 when he made his debut. And guess what? He's the best driver in F1 at the moment.
I just want to make a general point on what money buys you. So I had some people saying to me, well, okay, the Indy Lights or the USF 2000 or those feeder series, they won't take like personal money. They're running that series for their own reasons. And then there's sponsorships for people to move up. What the drivers who are currently competing in that might not have is the resources of, say, a Stroll. And when you look at the training Stroll had to get into F1, it was immense. They could literally go and buy a 2-year-old Formula One car, hire Anthony Davison, who is like just a national treasure, to personally train him. And it's that kind of training and resource in sport that makes apparent meritocracies into actually elite sports. So you might think, well, those seats will be safe because the American talent will still be fast. You might not know that you might not be able to compete against the amount of training and the amount of opportunity and track time and resources that I think probably exists more in Europe. And I might be wrong about that, Chris, but I do feel like it's just a bigger industry in Europe, especially at the youth driver level, if you look at karting level and above.
100%. And this is why it was so attractive to like skip a step, you know, and why it getting into F1 as quick as possible was a much more attractive option. Mm. We have multiple world champions from this century.
Oh, go on. Yeah, do this.
Skipped yeah. so many steps. Kimi Raikkonen had one or two mm-hmm. years of single from the Formula Renault level straight into F1. Jenson Button mm. came in from British Formula 3, not even a regional Formula 3 series, the national one. And I think Sebastian Vettel came in like halfway through his Formula Renault 3.5 season as well. And I'm sure there's another example I'm forgetting, but it's very clear that age and experience actually, when it boils down to it, is less important than the raw talent of these drivers.
Okay, but the super license system, though, it will stop things like this. Very famous stories in soccer of like agents showing showreels of players who did like a couple of good games and tricking top teams into signing them. So obviously it's a much smaller ecosystem, but you know, it's a checks and balances thing, Chris. It's you do need some kind of system. But I think the main argument here is, where should IndyCar fall into that system? Well,
do we need a system? Was it really so awful before the super license system came into place? Were we just having terrible Formula One drivers in the past? I mean, I really don't think it was all that bad before the super license came in.
Okay, but you could have a team pressured into having a driver nominated by their engine supplier who really isn't up to scratch and who would be a menace at the back of the grid, Matt.
Yeah, you could. And if memory serves, back in the day, you could apply to the FIA for an exemption. And if you could provide sufficient evidence, they would allow your driver to race. And I think I like the idea of rethinking how the points are distributed in IndyCar, especially because it, certainly if you finish top 10 in the championship, you should be getting more points than an F3 top 10 finisher, just because the cars are much closer together in performance, and it requires a greater degree of driver skill to do that well over the course of a season.
Last thing on this, because this boils down to how much respect should IndyCar get? And you know, I've watched a few races and it looks fast. It looks terrifying. Driving on an oval looks just insane. Like the amount of mental courage to get on an oval, do the practice, realize what it's all about and still do a race, that does require a little bit of a hat tip. And I think Lewis Hamilton has even said like, nope, ovals, not a chance. I just wouldn't do that. I think Ricardo has said that as well. And don't a lot of drivers opt out of the ovals in the IndyCar series and only do the road track? So look, it's an amazing discipline, but it is absolutely a slightly different discipline to Formula One. They're not trained. They're not doing the whole Pirelli tire thing. It's a different discipline. So what I would like to say to everybody here now is, let's take the best five Indy drivers, put them in F1. Take the best five F1 drivers and put them in Indy. What kind of things do we see, Steve? What do you think?
I think we've probably find that two of them would sit in the top 15 drivers, you know, comparable to F1. And I think the others would take a little time. You know, the actual style of racing, the style of car, takes some time to adjust to. And I think you're crazy if you don't expect that to happen. I think that what would happen if you said to some of those IndyCar drivers, here, you can go and give it a really good try in Formula One, I think that that would add excitement to Formula One.
I think so. I agree. Yeah.
It would add excitement to them, to the drivers themselves, and would give them an added, you know, kind of level of, let's really go do this. You know, we've got a chance that we've never had before. I mean, I think you've got to be sensible and make it some of the younger guys. The very oldest of the IndyCar drivers are probably, you know, just hanging on the shirt tail at the moment.
Well, the thing is, at the moment, what we've seen going to IndyCar, Matt, is the drivers who, you know, like Grosjean and Ericsson, who had a good shot, pretty talented, gone over to IndyCar. You know, we've not seen a Lewis Hamilton in his prime. You know, we're not going to see Verstappen go over there next season.
No, we won't. So that does, in a sense, make the comparison more difficult. But if you ask what would happen, I think Steve has the right of it. I think any top five, top 10 Formula One driver would be similarly placed in IndyCar. And I think if you reverse that equation, I'd ask, well, what team are we putting them in? Yeah. And then I'd go, they do about as well as whoever is there.
No. We send them to Williams, and that proves that IndyCar is definitely rubbish. So actually, my opinion on this is that I think they're probably more different disciplines than we think, you know, and I'd love to know, you know, people who've got more in-depth knowledge of both those series, but I think it is probably more like moving between rugby and NFL. Than we think it is, more like moving between cricket and baseball than we think it is. You know, it's all hitting a ball with a stick. It's all catching a ball and throwing it and running around. I think we're probably underestimating just how different those skills are. I think the top five drivers in Formula One go over there, take a long time to get used to it, don't necessarily dominate. It's such a different discipline. Again, I think you bring the top five drivers, you put them in the top five teams from Indy, you put them in the top five teams in F1, I think they will struggle similarly. And I wonder, Chris, if ultimately that's why the feeders, the points for the super license are graded as they are. F2 and F3 get more points because they are much more relevant to F1.
Maybe. I mean, I still think a big part of it is to force drivers to go a particular route.
You think it's money?
It came in around the time when they were completely rebranding the racing ladder by renaming it, you know, Formula 2 and Formula 3, and revitalizing and reshaping the way regional F3 series work, right down to their involvement in national Formula 4 championships from karting as well. So I think it was to make the racing ladder a much more elegant solution.
Right. So I will start by saying the biggest singular difference from IndyCar to Formula One has to be management of the ERS system. And you don't get that in any of the feeder series in the FIA. Having said that, I have no problem with F2 being the premier series leading to F1. You race on the same tracks, you're with the teams, you get exposed to the culture. But what might need to be rethought, especially in light of commercial possibilities, is the ability of independent world championships or regional championships, such as IndyCar. Drivers who prove themselves might need to be given the opportunity to move when the opportunity presents itself. And that will make Formula One an even more international series. And I'd hate for that opportunity to get lost in the technical details.
To be clear, in case anyone thinks I'm like anti-American, F1 needs an American driver soon, as soon as possible. Get the right guy in, get that American fan base fully solidified so that people can continue doing F1 podcasts. That's the sole reason that we need to get F1 drivers in. And that's why we've a good half an hour chat on that, Matt. But I enjoyed it. I feel like I was learning that entire time, which is great. But we've got loads of feedback in our listener email. I'm going to play Steve's fancy bumpers to give you time to find one. Hello, here at Missed Apex Podcast, we do some additional content. It's not better, but we do waffle on about things like our midlife crises and how best we should spend them. You don't want to get stuck in a midlife crisis involving Lycra. Don't do it. Don't go to road racing. That's the worst midlife crisis. You want to plan your midlife crisis properly. And that's the kind of thing we discuss on our patron-only Doom Scrolling podcast. We also have a great Slack forum, which you can join at certain patron tiers as well. So consider supporting us at patreon.com/missedapex. In general, I would like to say I've really enjoyed the interactions I've had with people this year. I have had some raging debates, some passionate debates, and some real good back and forths in my replies on Twitter and the DMs and in our Facebook group. I do love that. Just be warned, I'm not like a career media guy. So if you come at me with like a weird aggressive Snoopy attitude, I don't go, hmm, that's so interesting. Tell me more. I tend to go, I tend to match your energy, snip back, and then eventually block you. So please do come and chat to us, all of us, at MattPT55, at ChrisOnRacing. We've got to get Steve into Twitter. We've got to tell him what it is first. He'll be very, very shocked when he discovers what it is. And me at Spanners Ready, and find us on Facebook as well. We do love having a discussion. All we ask is that you be a little bit polite. And if you're not, don't be surprised if we have a little bit of a snip back. But also follow the show at Missed Apex F1 on Twitter also. All right, on with the mailbag. Matt, what have you found in your sack?
Excuse me?
I said, what email would you like to address next?
There we go. You'll not be happy to hear this.
Oh.
But after the super license, we had the most questions about Ferrari.
Okay. Let's do it.
So I think we'll start with Alistair, who wants to point out to us that he actually paid the bar tab for us in 2019 when we went karting.
He did. So. He did. We were at Barkmore Park and we just had this sudden mystery announcement from Marcia behind the bar who said, we've had X money put behind the bar, and it was wonderful. Thank you. Stuff like that is just incredible.
And he would very much like to know, do you think the truth of what Ferrari did with their 2019 engine will ever come out? Not like tomorrow, but maybe a decade or a generation or a century from now. Will we ever find out what they were up to with that power unit?
Chris, I think you're the right person to go to for this. Everything is conspiracy theory until, you know, you've got a Mark Priestley-style book that comes out about the 2007 series.
This is exactly what I was going to say. It's going to come out in someone's book at some point, or like 20 years down the line, if podcasts are still a thing, you'll have some guy from Ferrari being like, ah, yes, we did this.
We definitely cheated. Here's the proof.
Yeah, exactly. No, I think secrets are never in Formula One forever. Mm. Eventually, they tend to get exposed one way or another.
One of the issues I've been having with people online is, and it did happen a lot with the Toro Rosso thing. Toro Rosso, there I go again, sounding old. AlphaTauri stuff is that if something sus happens, I think it is reasonable to kind of go, hang on a minute. Because F1 has kind of been, you've been watching F1 a lot longer than I have. Quote unquote cheating is so part of the sport.
Well, the whole sport is premised on we push things as far as we can go. You know, the FIA put out a set of rules and engineers go to huge extent to, you know, push them. There's a very fine line between pushing it to the extreme and going that one millimeter further that makes it cheating. And engineers aren't necessarily known for having the best moral judgments in the world.
No. Do you know what I mean? Like, I've worked in like defense contracting, and it's all about the requirements that people set out. And sometimes you look at like a customer's requirements about, oh, it must have this, it must have this. And you go, I could drive a bus through those legal clauses. And it's the same in Formula One. And I wonder, Steve, though, where's your outrage limit? Like, what do you class as, oh, you kind of, you snuck one in, or oh, that was cheating? So, for example, in Britain, we don't like players overacting when they get taken down, well, you know, when they get a foul. In Italy, if you fool the referee into giving a penalty, that is seen as good play. That's good football. Well done, you tricked the referee.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together.
J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Yeah, I don't mind a team or an engineer or a driver individually pushing the bounds on an existing regulation or way of doing things. I do draw the line at stuff like engineering your teammate to crash into a wall so that you can win the race and have a better chance at winning the championship. That's just out-and-out cheating. Doing things that are technically slightly different, I think, comes into a grayish area that you need to arbitrate in order to be able to say, is it an out-and-out cheat? Or has this person, organization, or whatever, just pushed the regulation further than anybody else has managed to yet?
Let's go Chris, then Matt.
I liken it to the 10% safety buffer you get for speeding. If you're doing 54 in a 50 zone, you are technically speeding, but you're going to get away with it.
Yeah, and if you get pulled over, you can go, well, I thought I was doing that, and you can sort of explain yourself. So if it's
exactly
a 50 and you're doing,
was lying.
If you're doing 55, you go, oh, really? I could swear it was, I set my cruise control at 52. But if you're doing 70, you've got no defense.
Exactly.
Matt.
Yeah, well, without meaning to cast aspersions on Red Bull, I think they give us an excellent example of both sides of that singular coin. We all know last year that their rear wing flexed pretty tremendously, but then the FIA stepped in and said, we're going to set new limits on this. But that's absolutely fair. That's a perfect example of them using the materials and the rules and pushing as far as they can to gain maximum advantage. In fact, I'd argue their flappy upper element on the rear wing suggests that they may still be doing that in ways that no one has talked about yet. But that's for another show, perhaps with Summers.
Flappy upper element was my something something cover band in high school. Anyway, my favorite kind of rule break is the one where they do a thing, the FIA doesn't like it, and they go, I suppose that is actually technically okay, but you can't do it anymore and no one else can. That's probably the best rule break.
Yeah, so we're talking now like DAS or Frick or the F-duct, if you want to go back a ways. But what Red Bull also did with their front wing a few years ago, and they finally got dinged for it. I think they actually had a little mechanism, the one that changes the angle of the front wing, and at high speeds, it would just flop over and completely stall the front wing, getting rid of a whole bunch of drag. And that was flat out illegal, according to the rules. They only got away with it because they were never caught doing it till someone ratted them out.
Okay.
And so, to me, those are your bright lines right there.
Okay, so great example was we heard from the Lotus CEO, Matthew Carter, here on this show that in 2014, it was something like the front wing had to be a certain height, but the support would mysteriously break every time that the Lotus started the race. Therefore, it would mysteriously break and they would benefit from having a lower front wing. Yeah. But their thinking, and Matthew Carter was brilliant at saying that, was, well, I guess we only have to explain it when we get caught. We can go, oh, no. Oh, I can't believe it. And then from then on, they could can perform with that rule. Like, Steve, is that cheating? Where does that fall on your moral compass?
I think that's exploiting the regulation. I don't think, you know, I think it's okay for them to exploit it, but I think as soon as, you know, someone picked up on it and said, hey, guys, this is just outside the bounds of what we really meant, then it needs to be arbitrated and policed and, you know, they can't do it anymore. But don't blame them for trying to push the rules. That's what this game is about. That's what makes Formula One an interesting,
that's, you know, interesting
concept.
I would have thought that one was like an out-and-out cheat. Like, that is...
No, I don't think so.
Chris?
I think it also depends how public you are as a team, or how well you're doing, pretty much, because teams like Red Bull, Ferrari, Mercedes are going to be under constant scrutiny from each other. And no disrespect to Matthew Carter and his Lotus team, but that car finished, what, ninth?
It didn't,
in the championship. No one was really saying they've got a performance advantage somewhere.
Yeah, true. I think, you know, the Ferrari example from the emailer, thank you very much for your email. I think that one, there was quite a big, I think that one goes beyond loophole, if what allegedly has been alleged is allegedly correct. And that was circumventing like a very specific thing, which was, we need you to only have this certain fuel flow. And that's like a strict rule. They were avoiding being detected. It's very different to something like the Red Bull fuel flow cheat in 2014. They did a brilliant fuel flow cheat where basically once it was past the sensor, the tube was flexible enough to allow pressure to build up so that you had kind of a flexible reservoir of fuel. And then when you hit the throttle, you had more fuel available, but the flow to that point was less. Now, to me, that was just genius. Like, yeah, you did the rule. We'd never, ever unflowed more past your sensor than you determined. That was the rule. That was a brilliant cheat. Definitely still a cheat, though. But the Ferrari one seemed a little bit more like, no, this is a deliberate attempt to allegedly circumvent the rules, Matt.
Yeah, they allegedly got around the measuring of certain parameters of the engine very cleverly, I will add. And so points to them for that. But it was an intentional evasion of an FAA measurement. Whereas the Red Bull that you referenced on the, I think it was the high pressure side of the fuel injector, simply took advantage of there's no measurement on the other side of this. So they didn't evade any measurement to create that. It's a very small, but I think important detail.
Okay.
Anyway.
Well, I think we're going to move on with our mailbag. That was really, that was a very, very interesting like a tangent that we took around like how we feel about cheating in general. And whilst Matt rummages around in his sack, I've got a couple of things to say. I'm going to give a shout out to another F1 podcast. I don't normally do this, but I had a lovely time speaking to my new friends at the Red Flag podcast, and I was a guest there for, oh, it was 90 minutes. They let me go on and on and on, and I believe that will be released on Monday, the 19th of September. So why not go and check them out? Very different kind of show to what we do here on Missed Apex podcast. It's like the American version of For F1's Sake podcast, I would say. I think it is worth checking them out and seeing if you like what they do. All right, good. Time to press another button. All right, Matthew. Do you get Matthewed a lot?
Occasionally.
Do you? Are you in trouble?
It's my government name.
Oh, is it? I'm the same with Richard. Whenever I hear Richard, I'm like, uh-oh, I best pay attention. Someone, I have to pay a bill, or I didn't pay a bill, or tax is due. When you hear Matthew, it's bad news. Christopher. I bet Christopher's bad news for you.
Always.
Chris. Yeah. It's like that's like you forgot like your sister's birthday, or you were meant to go to a family celebration and you didn't.
I mean, I have no problem not going to family celebrations. I don't like them very much.
Okay, fair enough. Stephen, why are your flip-flops left out? They're all sandy and they've been out there for 4 months and they've got dingo turd on them.
The only person that calls me Stephen is Jane. And I okay. listen. Everybody else calls me Steve.
And the thing is, my wife knows that I stand to attention for, and it's always in this tone. It's not like Richard. It's Richard. It's like that. You know, yeah, with that little... Richard, I'm curious as to why this inexplicable scene in front of me that has been caused by you has occurred, and you will be required to give me a detailed explanation. So please do call me Spanners or Richie at the very least. Matt, Matty, Trumpets, Matty R, Matty T, what is next in your mailbag?
Well, we could talk more about Ferrari, but I want to answer this question because... After my own style, it is a three-parter from Jack Alston.
Okay, here we go.
But I think it'll be a good one. Question number one, should F1 be doing more to increase affordability for the average consumer? Question two, has the sport, not the teams, but the sport itself stopped innovating from watching? And he's wondering about the integration of more modern technology. And finally, after my own heart, a tech question. Why exactly was engine development frozen?
Okay, so...
Well, the third one's easiest.
Okay, go on then, Chris. I was actually going to say, the third one's the least interesting. I don't care. We did it to appease Porsche Red Bull, and now they're not coming anymore. And no. Like, why do we even bother?
It wasn't done to appease Porsche. It was done to appease Red Bull, though, because they're like, oh, we've got no manufacturer support for the next 4 years. And they go, oh, fine, you just leave it as it is until 2026 then. That is it.
But I will point out that we've had these engine freezes before in the latter years of most engine regulations, including the VH that preceded these.
Okay. So I think that was relatively simple. The second question on there, I think we'll take a deep dive into that. And then we will talk about the affordability because I'm very, very angry about all the Silverstone stuff. And I think lots of people, I'm hardly alone in that. But I think we'll talk about the innovation one first. Chris, is that right?
Yeah. So I read that question. I think they like referenced a lot of the TV technology as well, including the drones. Remember after Barcelona, we had a good old whinge about how appallingly awful that drone shot was.
No. But I was very clear to say, let's not whinge too much because they're innovating pedal cam. Helmet cam.
Dude, you are on my level because I was told after Budapest, they used that drone again. And it was like used all through the weekend. It's like, it was
didn't
seamless.
Even notice. You didn't even notice. Notice exactly, it. Exactly.
It was brilliant.
Steve, you need to chip in on this one.
Well, firstly, pedal cam is not a new innovation these days. It's just the return of something that they had
time
ago.
Supercars has been doing it since 1887.
No, they actually tried it in Formula One cars for a little while. And then I don't think the camera technology was up to it in those
days. Steve, it's good, but it's the wrong way round. I need to see it from the...
I agree with that. Yeah. I agree, totally. Yeah. I think you need to see it from the driver's side, not from behind the pedal. That's quite weird. I think it was just easier to put it in there. I think they're trying to, innovate in all sorts of media areas at the moment. There isn't a lot more that you can do with the technology that we've got. We've got miniature cameras. They're trying those in the helmets.
Yeah.
And they've improved those this year. When earlier in the year they were, really shaky and bad. Yeah. They've obviously got some kind of stabilization going on. And they look good. I think that they are trying to innovate. I think that technology hasn't opened up any new avenues for them for a little while yet.
Well, I like the visor cam. I like where they're going. And I think I just sent you, if I'm not mistaken, Steve, an example of a gyro cam on the Ferrari showing the banking at Zandvoort.
And it's nice that they've caught up with MotoGP bikes after 10 years.
Okay.
But I guess the point is they haven't stopped putting new ideas.
Oh, no, that's true. They haven't.
And evaluating. And so I think the news on that is going to be good. They want to innovate so that they equal other sports so that they make more money. So
the problem with the gyro cam for cars is this Zandvoort's about the only track that we race on where you get to really see the result of the gyro one. On a normal flat course, it makes little or no difference whether it's gyroed.
Connor in our patron chat group says we should have a fuel flow cam. Yeah, I agree. Let's do that. And can we backdate it to 2018, 2019, if possible, please? Chris?
Yeah, I mean, my point was going to be about the gyro cam as well. So in terms of the television, I think they're still pushing the boundaries. In terms of the cars,
yes,
are they pushing the bounds still? I mean, you could argue that the hybrid technology came in way after other series had adopted it. But has Formula One pushed the boundaries further in a shorter amount of time?
Lots to say on that. I just want to double check, Steve. We had quite a few broadcasting points, I think, before we move on.
Yes, I reckon the next innovation I want to see is drivers being able to talk to each other.
Oh, hang on a minute. Now then. We've been experimenting with that kind of stuff at the Mist Apex karting event. And obviously, we do have that with our iRacing events, where you can choose to be in the group lobby or you can choose to be in a private channel with just your team. I think it's obvious that in reality, that's a terrible idea. It would be kind of cool, maybe in practice, Chris, if they had a session where you had open comms. It's technologically possible.
I mean, I think it would be great in races if you have two drivers clattering into each other and you could just get the direct response. That'd be great. But yeah, no, I think in theory, great. But in reality, not so much.
I don't know if you ever have watched Texas Hold'em Poker on TV.
Yes. Yes,
but I have. Why is that televised? No,
one,
I haven't.
To what? Watch one player.
Why? Of course, it's amazing. That's why.
To watch one player talk their way right through another player. Say, can you imagine being behind someone and they're just like, I'm coming. I'm coming. I know you're going to miss
Google
that
corner. Google Kevin Hart playing Texas Hold'em Poker and just getting in everyone's head. And he's not the best player at all, but he just like fully Kevin Hart's it and like flummox top players. It's really good. It can't happen. It's far too, it's like sledging in cricket. And in cricket, it works very well. But how many times in cricket, Steve, have we seen batsmen just been absolutely psyched out and get themselves out because the wicketkeeper's been chirping behind them and the Australians are the kings of sledging?
Yeah, I can't deny that one little bit that happens often. And I was being tongue-in-cheek about the drivers talking to each other, but boy, it'd be brilliant.
Steve, you're a producer on this show and you're the one doing naughty words. I've got to edit that out now. Don't worry, naughty Steve. But in Australia, oh, by the way, I should say, in Australia, you have much, like, you don't mind swearing at all. We did have an advert go out that only went to our Australian listeners that had expletives in it. And we decided not to, like, withdraw it or get too upset about it because Australians have different standards. But if you were offended by that, I do apologise.
So do I.
Yeah. But things like speaking to the driver, Johnny Herbert had a conversation with Nico Rosberg, I think, in 2015, and they experimented with that as a post-race interview. Formula E have done that, and I think W Series experimented with in-car interviews. And I thought they worked very well, but I think I'm alone, Steve. People didn't really like them.
I think they work well. I think the very best piece of participant-to-participant communication I ever saw was in the 80s. It was the Bathurst 1000. They had the leader of the Bathurst 1000 talking to the captain of the Australian-America's Cup yacht race thing that was happening in Perth. So we had these two guys involved in different races, one in a car, one in a yacht. They were both high-level things, and they talked to each other. It was the first time that had ever been tried, and I sat there gobsmacked that anybody was able to do it. It was brilliant. So I think that's the very best piece of participant-to-participant communication I've seen.
No, that's fine, Steve. I'm just still recovering. I'm just so sad that this is the first episode that I encouraged my children to listen to live. I didn't really. Chris?
What if we had celebrities talking to drivers after the races?
Oh, God.
Say, like, Will Smith, and he can tell them that's how he done told them to do it.
Yeah, and then reach into their car and slap them in the face.
Sounds great.
Allegedly. Oh, no, we all saw it was literally on telly.
Yeah. We don't need to cover ourselves on this one. The lawyers are fine.
Yeah, they're fine. We saw it all. Okay, Chris, where you tried to take us, and I do apologise, I just knew that Steve had another point.
No, that's fine.
When it comes to innovation in cars, Actually, the question I nearly tweeted out earlier was, what technologies could we just wholesale remove from F1 and it not really have an effect? Like, we're already losing the MGU...
H.
Yeah, H. Well, I was getting to that. You didn't have to tell me. I was getting there. But, you know, there's a whole technology that just got taken away. Like, we could take away maybe half of the stuff there. And I guess we would need to stay quicker than IndyCar so that we could keep rejecting their drivers wholesale.
That's not going to be difficult. Because yeah. It's not so much to do with the power, though, is it? It's to do with the downforce.
Yeah, and the lap. But we want to maintain the lap time. People did get upset when it got down to GP2 levels. Yeah. But that doesn't mean we want to, like, just strive for infinite lap time. But there's a lot of technology that they could lose.
What, in terms of the engines or in terms of other things?
I don't know.
Things?
Like, I mean, do you need DRS? Do you need a button that cools the engine? Do you need the drinks dispenser? What
yes.
can you get rid of?
Yeah, yes, I know. You need a drinks dispenser.
Yeah. But
I wouldn't class DRS as like a technology because it's not used to really make the car go faster. It's a band-aid overtaking solution more than anything else that then got, like, they then introduced movable aerodynamics into road cars for that exact same reason on like the more like high performance hypercars that you see on the road from like Ferrari or McLaren or things like that. In terms of the other technologies that are coming into Formula One, I think they're so minuscule and under the radar and invisible that we get this sense that Formula One isn't going anywhere, when really, when you look at it, they are pushing the technology of the hybrid systems more and more every single year. Synthetic fuels, obviously a big talking point at the moment as well. That Formula One, I think, every once in a while does a media campaign around, but doesn't do anything to consistently tell the story of what's happening with developing technologies.
We've got some good suggestions in the live chat. Morgan is saying side pods. Just ask Mercedes. Oh, remember when that seemed like a good idea? Let's hope the W14 has side pods. I'm thinking side pods, pretty good. Let's see. Someone asks, is Latifi a technology? No. rear view mirrors, could we do without them? I guess the meme would be that Lance Stroll could do without them. Tim Rudd's suggestion of just getting rid of wings. I love that. I love that suggestion, get rid of wings, like across the whole like ladder. But I think the aerodynamics is such an integral part of the industry and the fabric of F1. I just cannot imagine that they would ever like dismiss and fire the half of every aero team by getting rid of wings.
You'd still have an aero team for like ground effect, and that they just all be pushed onto how do we generate downforce through a floor rather than through a wing.
And Martin makes the suggestion, Matt, that all invisible tech should be banned. And I think that's the core of a lot of people's complaints, is we can't see the thing that makes that car faster. We can't see the thing that made the difference today.
Yeah, well, it's actually a really unfortunate side effect of these new regulations that have worked well to make the racing closer, and we certainly enjoyed seeing them on racetracks, is that a lot of what is making the difference isn't visible anymore, because it's not just aerodynamics. They changed so much about the suspensions as well, and that's really adjusting the car track to track through the suspension, and the balance is a lot of what's making these weird circuit-specific differences that we see and we know, like, oh, how Red Bull's 10 seconds faster. Oh, look, Ferrari's now faster than Red Bull. A lot of it is down to the track and the ability of the teams to adjust these hidden bits of the car to use the tires and their own concept best.
Well, of course, Red Bull's massive performance gains have come from trimming the weight down. They went from being 20 kilos overweight to now pretty much being on the weight limit. So are we saying that you can't do anything to change the weight of your car? We will never improve anything if we never do that.
Minor point, Red Bull's improvement is all down to Max Verstappen, Max, Super Max. If you want to leave us an iTunes review, specifically in the Netherlands, just go on your iTunes, search for Missed Apex Podcast, leave us a little 5-star review, hashtag Super Max. Matt?
It's not just that. They spent an enormous amount of time and effort working on the throat to the floor so they can better balance the car. That's the other side of it. The weight is responsible for the lap time, but they've spent all their currency working, being more gentle on the tires. Let's just call it that. But Weedsy in the chat has the best example of tech we can use, which is let's get rid of some of the buttons on the car. You have settings for mid, entry, exit, high, low speed, diff. Maybe we could simplify some of that and make it a little more of a driver series again.
Do you remember, was it Baku? It was definitely Hamilton Rosberg.
Yeah.
And they, for one season, they banned driver to team communications.
Oh, gosh, yes. And they sent poor Lewis out with the wrong setting on his dial.
Yeah,
Rosberg with the right one. And he changed it, but he knew what to change it back to because he'd been on the right thing to start with. And Lewis was like, I'm going to try every one. And the engineers were like,
no,
please, Lewis.
Yeah.
Please don't blow up our car.
Yeah. But Hamilton was sitting there just going, well, if you don't tell me what to do, I'm just going to press every single button here until I find the right solution. And the engineers sitting there going, well, if you do that, you will break the car. But they couldn't do anything. And that actually illustrated a couple of things. A, that rule didn't work. It was public pressure to go, oh, well, there's too many instructions. The engineers are driving the car for them. But I think there was a point. It's just that you couldn't take away the engineer advice within the technology that we have. And there was a quote, was it from Andretti? I don't know if it was from Andretti.
Yeah.
You know the quote I'm going to say, which is that I would rather go back to IndyCar because I want to drive a car, not press buttons.
That's the one.
Steve, then Chris.
Wasn't the situation in the late 80s, early 90s that engineers were controlling all of the technical elements of the car from the pit wall, ride height, you know.
With Williams.
And they had to ban that because really the driver was just steering it and the engineer was setting it up for every corner that he came to.
On that, the team radio ban, not the outright ban, but obviously the engineering speak as well. I think what drove that as well was, I can't remember who Nico Rosberg's engineer was, but he would get on the radio to him and say, oh, by the way, Lewis is taking this line and then getting on the power 2/10 earlier than you at this particular corner. Everyone got outraged at that, completely forgetting about the fact that as soon as Nico parks up in the garage, that's the kind of data he's going to be looking at anyway. All they've done is streamline the process.
Yeah.
So just wanted to highlight what an utterly ridiculous rule that was.
Yeah, I think you're never going to stop that with teammates, Matt. I mean, we've both benefited in sim racing where we've had the traces from faster drivers' inputs, and you can just copy it. You go, Brad hit the brakes and softer, but earlier, and you just do that same thing, and then you watch your sector time go down. So I think that's a normal part of having a teammate.
Yeah, in fact, it's one of my favorite all-time treasured Formula One memories at Barcelona with Rosberg and Hamilton battling for the win, and their engineers spying on each other's side of the garage and radioing in ERS changes. Is like literally, it's not just the driver, but the whole team fighting each other, trying to win the race. It was just spectacular. And then they immediately banned it.
But I also
was like, nope, none of this.
for the health of the team, that's not good.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
It being a truly team sport and, you know, those relationships with like Felipe Massa and why has the name suddenly disappeared from me? Help.
What, Alonso?
No, Felipe Massa's engineer.
Rob Smedley.
Rob Smedley, there we go. Brilliant. And this relationship with Lewis Hamilton and Bono, you know, those kind of things are magic. You know, that's a great story. That's the relationships movies will be made about in future years. So I kind of do like that team element, and it exists whether we see it or not. The last part, though, Matt, of whose question was it?
This would be our friend Jack Alston.
Oh, thank you, Jack. So we've got far enough into the end of the show that I feel like we can have a little bit of a moan and a whinge. So what was the first part of his question about Silverstone?
Should F1 be doing more to increase affordability for the average consumer?
So Formula One is a business, and I'm sure people will raise that point and we'll talk about the business side and commercial side of running a racetrack and running a series. I just wanted to kind of speak for 10-year-old Richie, who was sat at home watching those Grand Prix and loving them, and being, you know, I don't want to get into the four Yorkshiremen of like, you had an hole in a road, you were lucky. Oh, we were huddled in corridor. You know, I don't want to get into all that, like, woe is me, violins playing. But I was at the lower end of the socioeconomic ladder in the UK, and going things like going to Grand Prix tracks were already expensive. I was priced out of going to Grand Prix. And when you think, like, growing up, it was the sport I loved the most. And I the moments where I could go karting, the endurance league that I was able to enter for 1 year, the times I got to do arrive and drive were some of the most special memories of my entire life. And motorsport is expensive, and it was unobtainable, really, for a kid like me growing up. And I dreamed of, you know, growing up, I'm going to get a job, and then I'll be able to go and do all those things. And I think I've managed, you know, two occasions, two single days, where I've managed to go to a Formula One event at Silverstone. But a lot of people were already priced out. Now the prices have gone up. And I could accept prices going up. It's in higher demand. Higher demand means higher prices. I can see that. So it's very much still aspirational. And as a grown-up with my own money to spend, I then had a family to think about. And it's a selfish thing for me to then buy those tickets. Now it comes to the TV side of it, where you say, well, it's a TV sport then. I'd kind of made my peace with that. And you've heard me on many occasions being very upset at people talking about the Monaco Grand Prix and going, yes, it might be boring for you plebs at home, but you just simply have to be there. How can you possibly judge the Monaco Grand Prix if you're not sipping Chardonnay at turn one? I have accepted, yes, F1 has been largely a TV sport for me in the past. And then F1 sells the rights to F1 to Sky TV. Sky TV. It's a great production, what they do for Sky F1. Can't fault it at all. But it took that from a license payer's free to air, like an NHS type thing, to a private medical care type thing. I then had to sign up to Sky TV and pay whatever it is, ridiculous amounts a month, for one channel, literally one channel. And so luckily, as a grown-up, I wasn't priced out. But me, as a young lad in the 90s watching F1, if that had been the case, I literally would have been priced out of watching Formula One. I would not have this lifelong passion I would have had for Formula One. My passion for boxing, for example, got completely taken away a little bit later for cricket, completely taken away by that pay-per-view. But this latest episode from Silverstone and what they've done, they haven't just increased prices. I think they really have just ripped the soul out of the F1 going and seeing it in person, fan experience. And the thing that got it for me was not just that the price has increased with demand. I understand business-ish to an extent. I have sympathy for the fact that it costs money to run a Grand Prix. I can even understand dynamic pricing. The fact that if I look for an airplane ticket at various times, the price might be different, whether I book it right before the event, whether I'm looking at a premium ticket or a premium date. The fact that people were queuing for hours, thinking they had one price, waiting for the system to update, and then they would suddenly be faced with a much higher price. And they've just invested 5 hours sitting there. And you can't, it doesn't just hold. You have to, once it appears, you have to click within 5 minutes or you lose it and you have to start again and you have to join the queue again. So you've put all that emotional investment in, and then you go, right, well, will I pay more? I was already actually stretched for the prices that I saw. And now I have to decide whether that is a sunk cost. So they are feeding on the sunk cost fallacy, the sunk cost mental block that all of us will have. And you go, and you make a decision, well, I've waited this long, so I'm going to pay. And that, to me, feels like extortion. And I am upset. I think it's a good question. And I feel upset about how much F1 has been taken away from me as a viewer. I've spoken for a long time. I do apologize, but I think you can tell I'm very passionate about that. And you tell me I'm wrong. I'm fine. You're at me, at Spanners Ready. Email me, spanners@missedapex.net. Chris?
I think as Formula One's popularity has grown over the last couple of years, because it really has shot up.
Yes.
Lately,
yes,
it's becoming more of like a sort of touristy thing to do, and I can almost sort of mirror it to me looking to take a holiday this year, my one and only holiday that I'm going to be taking this year, and I don't really feel like going to another country. And I just want to do a staycation and just, you know, book a place for a few weeks. But the amount of money to do that just for 3 or 4 days is ludicrous. And everyone's telling me you're better off going to another country and taking a holiday there in some resort. And it's becoming the same with Grand Prix. You are going to be better off going to Barcelona or Bahrain or just somewhere else.
Uncle Steve, was that it was too much, that rant, a little bit? I could feel it as I was doing it, but I'm upset a bit.
Well, you have every right to be upset. I saw that and was just disgusted at what was going on. I think that they're just flagrantly ripping, the fans off, people who want to go there. I totally agree with you. I understand that, okay, ticket prices will be more this year than last year because more people want them this year.
Yeah, I can accept
that. But not, as you say, sitting in the queue waiting to buy your ticket and then find it's $100 more when you get to the, press the buy button. Yeah. I think that's outrageous. But you only had to look at Miami and what went on there in terms of it.
It works.
Yeah, but they were charging people huge amounts of money for, what were, normal general admission tickets. And what the news that's been coming out about what's going to happen in Las Vegas is making my,
tell me, go on then. I'm ready. I'm ready, Steve. Tell me what's happening in Las Vegas.
Oh, well, they reckon that, a normal general admission price could be $2,000.
Whoa, okay. Wow. Okay, so only trumpets can afford that amongst us.
Well,
$2,000.
I appreciate that Liberty bought a slab of real estate on the strip in Las Vegas in order to have the pit straights on, and they're going to turn it into some kind of display for the rest of the year. And I suppose that cost them $50 million or something. I suppose they're going to have to find that money. But holy moly, they're really ripping it out of, the fans. And I've got to put this question to you. How many people at the moment? Yes, DTS has meant the last 2 years there's been a huge increase in the popularity of the sport. Mm. How many people are going to still be there in 5 years' time after we've been ripped off gutless for 5 years? How many people are going to say, no, sorry, I'll find something else to spend my time and my money on?
Is anyone willing to make a case for the defense? No. Matt. No, okay, no. Okay, Matt.
I'll make a case.
Okay, good, good. Matt, no. Don't, please don't at Matt. He's making a measured case for the defense.
I am indeed. And you have acceded to what I'm going to argue. To me, the crime of Silverstone, not to bang on too long about that, but is exactly the two things. One, how long it took. Mm. Two, the fact that the price changed after you clicked on it. I think both of those verge on criminal, from my point of view, treatment of the fan. I think it's fair to say, I'm going to have a Las Vegas Grand Prix. I have 5,000 seats to sell. And based on that, I think I can get $2,000 a ticket. And if I sell them all at that, then I've made a huge amount of money. And that's business. I think if you're going to do that, though, you do have to ask yourself, how am I going to invite people into my sport who cannot afford it? And that is what I worry about. And that is why your boxing analogy was absolutely spot on, because we have seen this happen before, and we don't want it to happen to F1.
I wonder if people think that the boxing fan base suffered because it was one of the most popular sports in Britain, with Frank Bruno taking on Mike Tyson. Those were epic TV moments, but really people did tune out en masse. And I think the same thing has sort of happened with cricket, and we'll see the effects in the future with cricket, but we've seen the effects with boxing now. Is it a case of milking the cow, too early? You've got to feed the cow, here, this, it feels like milking the cow with the pay to view on the cable side. And when it comes to the stadium side, I understand why the prices are going to rise, because it's the popularity has grown. And I don't have some kind of moral right to go and see Grand Prix because I've been watching it from 1980. Everyone has the same right to go and see the tracks and to see the races at the tracks. Therefore, the demand is higher, and that's how business works. And someone in our live chat said, if you can't afford a Rolex, you can't afford a Rolex. And F1, watching F1 live, has kind of become a Rolex. So I can see the practical economic side, but I reserve my right to feel super sad and almost grieve that my home Grand Prix is out of reach, Matt. I don't think I'm ever going to watch my home Grand Prix again. That's the realization I had. I love Silverstone. I love the racing that's there. I don't think I'm ever going to watch my home Grand Prix again.
Yeah, well, and I feel for you because this has always been the weird discontinuity of Formula One. It is a rich man's sport, rich person's sport, always has been. And yet, somehow, a whole bunch of people who aren't rich absolutely love it. And the people at Liberty, if they're really the business geniuses they think they are going to need to properly accommodate both sides of this in order to keep Formula One where it is right now.
Didn't Bernie readily admit that he wasn't interested in, you know, the low-paying scum? He was only interested in, you know, the rich people. He must be sitting back and laughing right at the moment.
Yeah, and look, the same thing, you know, football fans have had to put up with the same thing as well, where the pricing of the Premier League is just like shot through the roof. And, you know, I'm a supporter of a lower league club, but even I have seen prices and gone, what? £25 to go and watch Colchester United versus Leyton Orient? That used to be £3.50, that did, in the family enclosure at Layer Road.
Oh, speaking of things that used to be £3.50, now I'm paying £6 or £7 a pint in London. That's absolutely ludicrous. But no, I want to say it's not just football either. It's rugby as well. I really, really wanted to go and watch Six Nations match this year. Anywhere other than Twickenham, I maybe would have been able to do, but it would have, you know, involved a 6-hour trip to Cardiff. If I wanted to just pop down the road to Twickenham, would have cost me 700 or more quid.
All right. Well, I think that brings us towards the end of the mailbag show. I've enjoyed this show, but we didn't talk about like any current F1 stuff, like how the championship's going. It was all very kind of ethereal topics. And I don't mind that. You know, the core of the sport we covered with the cheating and what counts as cheating and what would we accept as cheating. I don't mind that. I don't mind spending some time talking about the fan experience and how we consume it. I would love to have seen F1 cars in real life more than two times. Maybe I should be forced to get on a plane and get in my car and go across continental Europe. The only thing is, the only thing is, Chris, I do feel like over the last couple of years, I do need to avoid the Orange Army just a little bit. So, like, I'm sure Zandvoort is fun. I don't think I'm going to go and just tip up at the general admission at Zandvoort, though.
Or at Spa.
Or
in Austria.
Yeah.
Or the other ones that they all go to.
How's Hungara Ring? Is there a lot of...
I think there's quite a few there as well, actually. Yeah. But Hungara Ring, you get a good...
So if you see me like suddenly like morphing into a Verstappen fan, it's just because I want to get lower ticket prices at Zandvoort, Spa, Hungara Ring, etc.
I mean, what I was going to say, you know, the other topics available, what are we going to talk about? The driver market, where really we don't know what's going to happen for quite
stuff.
A while. You have just got to wait and see.
Matt. Don't give away next week's show.
It's a teaser, Matt.
Hey, look, there's lots of really interesting things planned for Missed Apex podcast. We're going to be, I think we're experimenting quite a lot in the latter part of 2022. So if you see some shows that you go, oh, that's a bit different, that's a little bit of a different format, we'd love your feedback, but we are trying out some different stuff. We've had, I think, from a podcast point of view, a very successful year. We've got a lot of good feedback. We've had a lot of great features. The mailbag show has been absolutely fantastic. I think the magazine shows have gone down very well as well, where we have like 3 or 4 pre-recorded segments. And something I really want to drive towards, which has been successful in our patron-only podcasts, is having a call-in element. Risky, I know. Some people are definitely going to tip up and just call me a turnip, and we'll just have to deal with that. But I definitely want to have some out-and-out call-in shows. We are experimenting with the technology, and we think we're nearly there. And then we will form a solid plan for 2023 and see what we like and whether we want to stick or twist with each part.
A good thing as well, Spanners, we have a proper off-season as well this year because of the World Cup.
Because
the season ends in November rather than a week before Christmas. So We've got that good content, filler time.
So the thing with the off season is we are largely dictated and driven by the races and by the news beat and the news content. When the off season was longer, when we first started doing this, Matt and Chris, we used to have months. We used to have like 3 months to fill, and you go, oh no, how are we going to fill that content? Actually, I think that was some of our most fun podcasting, because we just got to explore all the different elements of F1 unencumbered by the current news beat or cycle or races.
We agree.
Good. Then we're definitely going to do that this off season as well. Go and follow my panel at MattPT55. Go follow him on Twitter and search for Matt Trumpets on Facebook. Search for Chris at Chris on Racing on Twitter and TikTok.
And Instagram.
Oh, there we go. Go and follow him. You can look at pictures. He likes to take pictures of himself in a shower, but don't get too excited. He does it in a full wetsuit covered in duck food. I don't know why. I don't know like why you do that.
A full Parker jacket with the hood up as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And those scuba diving flip-flop things.
and a snorkel.
Yeah, and a snorkel. I don't know why he does it, but it's good content. Steve Amy does not have social media, so you will have to go to his house in Brisbane.
Yep.
Okay.
Come along. You're all welcome. I promise I won't send you any pictures of me in the shower. Who would want to see that?
There's only you and Jono in Australia. If I was to organise some kind of Australian meetup with you and Jono as the hosts, I'm sure you could have a few jars with our Aussie listeners, and you could say you could say all the naughty words you want, Steve. How much does it cost to fly to Australia? I've never been. I think it's like £8,000.
Well, it's fairly expensive. It's been a long time since I've flown out of here too, but it would be $2,000 to $2,500 at least. Yeah,
maybe it's next on our checklist of family adventures. But wherever we see you next, guys, we hope that you will stay with Mr. Apex Podcast. Leave us an iTunes review. Consider being a patron supporter. Look in the show notes in YouTube and your app, and you will see where you can follow everyone. And I will implore you, please, 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 go and check out what we're doing with our iRacing tournament. It's a great broadcast with professional commentary. We've literally got professional Steve Amy doing all our broadcasts. It looks and feels like a real race event, and it's just a fantastic community. And I hope people will get involved and check that out.
And professional Chris Stevens.
I really like it. All the attention's on me
for a little bit. Hey, let Chris Stevens' commentary wash over you. And also just see the fact that I'm fourth out of 50 amongst a lot faster drivers, because I'm kind of old and I just keep on trucking while everyone crashes. Keep on trucking. Keep on racing, Spanners. It's okay. You stick at your pace, everyone else will fall down. And it's worked. I'm currently fourth. That won't last, but go and watch my rise to fourth place in the championship. But wherever we see you next, work hard. Be kind and have fun. This was Missed Apex Podcast.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love, and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.